Muller House Meeting, Saturday afternoon, 25th September 1976. Where there is the reality of communion, where there is the state of true meditation, the true samadhi, which means the supreme togetherness, there is also the reality of transcendent divine love. So let us converse together this afternoon on love. It is so easy to talk about love, to have wonderful thoughts, deep and moving feelings, which we call love. But whatsoever I may say or think or feel as love is only the shadow, not the reality of love in its full simplicity and in its transcendence. Neither the word love, nor what poets may have written about it, nor any of our exalted moods and conditions which we imagine to be love, even approach this transcendent reality. So you must discount everything that I say about it. And yet, what more wonderful, what more inspiring, healing, than to converse together on love. I deliberately use the phrase converse together. That means a going forth from the speaker and a response from the listener. Now I used the phrase divine love. Where lies the origin of this transcendent love? We have spoken about the creative action of the creative energy throughout the universe, this creative power which is in perpetual activity. It is not perpetual in the sense of active in time and space, but in terms of eternity, something that is quite other than time and space, transcends it, and at the same time contains it completely and wholly. What we know as love, all our supreme visions in our ordinary state of love come within time and space. And that is why our love begins somewhere, it grows, it can be hurt, it can cause hurt, it can decay, it can die. But this divine love never was born, never grows, never dies. It doesn't belong to the realm of mortality. It is of the realm of immortality. But it contains all that belongs to mortality. If it didn't, you or I could never touch this, never experience it, never know anything about it. We'd be completely blind, completely unaware from the moment we are born till we die of this transcendent reality. This creative action in eternity, then, is the ultimate source of divine love. This creative action is itself communion, is itself perpetual meditation, samadhi. It is transcendent love. These are words. Try to listen with the mind quiet, not blank, because then there can be no reception, no living reception in you, and no living response from you, no stir from within which could take you to this supremely transcendent bliss which man can ever attain ultimately. So, listen with the mind at peace, with the heart quite open, not letting yourself be disturbed, because memories are bound to come up. When one talks of love, one immediately drops back into the past and one suffers from the ill effects of the fossils we have put in this little museum of our memory box. So listen with a quiet mind, an open heart, in the state of true peace and happiness. This creative action in eternity, in itself, can never be talked about at all. But this creative action in eternity is realized, made real, in the deepest states of meditation possible to mankind. That is, when man is in true communion, in the state of true communion. When he emerges, comes back out of that state of communion, in which all separative self-consciousness has altogether disappeared, when he comes back, and begins to be conscious gradually in the ordinary way, he is conscious not of himself as a living organism in the world. He is conscious of man in the condition which is represented in the statement that God created man in his own living image. Now be very careful. God, the transcendent reality, has no language like ours, has no brain like ours, no psyche like ours, and therefore God is right beyond this creative power, in other words, is right beyond all thought forms, all concepts, all ideas. Beyond everything that is perishable. This is what the perfected Holy One, a man, can realize in the profoundest states of consciousness. But he has no thoughts about it. He has no knowledge in our ordinary sense about it. But when he slowly comes back to the realm, involves back into matter, the descent of the spirit into matter, as we sometimes call it, when he does that, he becomes conscious of man in that transcendent reality. The man that was never born, and the man that never dies. The created by this creative energy, therefore immortal. As his awareness involves, gets tied up more and more into the realm of the mortal, he translates that experiencing afterwards as having been in a state in which man is a hermaphrodite, a man and a woman combined together, a male and a female, a positive and a negative. But don't think of this in the shape of men and women like ourselves, not at all. He becomes aware of the activity of this creative energy in terms of positive and negative, male and female. And when a conception forms inside him about it, he represents that conception as the supreme person, the Purushottama of the Gita. The supreme person, or as a person, a Purusha. I am using this word for a good reason. How does a man ever come to enter this state and then talk of it afterwards in this manner? The word Purusha is explained in the Upanishads in this way. Purva, meaning formally, Purva. He, through purification of himself, burnt up all evil-mindedness, sarvam papmanam, burnt up all evil-mindedness. In the Sanskrit, root for burning up is ush. So the two parts of purva, pu and ush, were combined, and the word purusha, the person, was formed. This is the supreme person, the utterly purified man, you or I, who has come to complete fulfillment and realize this divinity, this state of divinity. Remember, everything that has been taught and presented about that which is divine and transcendent has had to be produced out of the mind of man functioning here. Otherwise, you can't talk about it at all. Brain can only communicate with brain in terms of language and words. So we have to bear this fact in mind. So now, this man, in a state where there is no body as such, is presented as a man and a woman combined in the Upanishads. In the Bible, as you know, the Lord God causes a sleep to fall upon Adam. What is this sleep which the Lord God causes? Yahweh, which is the immanent power within man, interacts with Elohim, that same divinity as the creative power of the whole universe. Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, not just Lord or God, but the Lord God, caused a sleep to fall upon Adam. What is this sleep? It's not going to sleep in the way we go to sleep. It's the entering into the deep states of consciousness, one of the profoundest states. And in that state, the Lord God takes a rib out of Adam and fashions a woman out of it. Now, the people who produced Genesis and the books of the Torah were deeply versed in the Kabbalah. And they talked of the primordial man, the man in the image of God, first and foremost as the man in the sky. In the Veda, is presented as the Purusha in Akasha. The man in the sky, the zodiac, from Aries through all the signs up to Pisces. This is the primordial man in the sky. A system of energies functioning in such a way that they represent all the potentialities that lie within you and me here and now on this planet. This is the primordial man created in heaven, so to say. Now, the constellation of Virgo, the Virgin, was associated by them more than 4,000 years ago, before the days of Abraham, with the region of the ribs in the body. Now, it's very interesting. Virgo is the woman, the virgin, the everlasting virgin, who is also the everlasting fertile mother. These are very deep and wonderful things if one meditates on them carefully and grows to understand them. So you see why Genesis presents it that way and the Upanishads present it the other way. The man and the woman together. And then the Upanishad teaches that the man who was a male and a female together felt lonely, so he desired a second. Instead of remaining just one, he desired a second. And he caused this same himself to fall apart into two. The root word for fall apart is pat in Sanskrit. Pat, to fall apart. And so, one part was called pati, the male, which means a husband in the dictionary, but I like to present it as the sovereign lord, the sovereign male, the supreme male or positive energy throughout the universe. And the female, represented as the wife, is patni, from pat to fall apart. Now the hint which is given in the Upanishads to indicate that obviously this was not a physical creature who fell apart in two pieces, otherwise there might have only been a funeral afterwards. To indicate that this refers to something transcendent, Yajnavalkya, the teacher, goes on to say that it is as if it were that this void was filled with the feminine. And the word used is akasha, this void, this emptiness which is the plenitude. The void became the woman. The plenitude, the potential plenitude became the woman. In the Kabbalistic teaching, she is presented as Esha. Esha is the daughter of Esh, the creative fire. So you can see what the real meanings are underlying all this. When they fell apart, the male, pati, conjugated with patni, the female. The positive and the negative energies of the universe sprang into conjugative activity. Now this is the important fine point to bear in mind. Remember, we are in a dimension on a plane which is transcendent yet, which is not perishable, not perishing, not born, not dying. This state of conjugation in eternity is a permanent state. The male female are in continuous creative action. We can only use words which for us have a biological meaning, because there are no words in the dictionary, as far as I know, in any dictionary to explain this. See? But this is the timeless conjugation of the original sovereign lord and sovereign lady, which keeps the entire universal process, not only with respect to living creatures, but with respect to the entire universe, going. Now you see, the extraordinary significance of all this. Here is the origin of divine love. This is the divine love. This timeless, conjugative, creative activity of the positive and negative forces of the entire universe, whatever the total reality may be. and it is transcendent. There is no desire involved in it, no possessiveness involved in it. There is no separative consciousness of I and you in it. There is no trace of wanting or trying to make one that which is in essence two. In essence, it is a not two. So you see the significance of the absolute purity of the whole situation. That is why in all the great mythologies and religious teachings of the world you have this presented. The ever virgin and ever productive fecund mother. Go into this deeply in the quiet. And you will understand what is meant by immaculate conception and virgin birth. Now this, which keeps going, this timeless conjugation, is what we call eros. In the Greek myth, it is called karma in Sanskrit. Now, the real meaning of eros is that eros brings forth all the gods and the archangels and angels and so forth. That simply means that this conjugative activity produces the great archetypal forms in which this transcendent energy will function throughout the universe. I mentioned, I think yesterday, yes, that the archetypal forms represent the principal ways in which we become conscious of these transcendent energies. So we give them names, we attach qualities to them. If you take the name of the archangel Michael, he who is like God. The Hebrews had the angel, great angel Metatron, who is the substitute for God. And Yahweh is also known as Yahoel and Yahoh. See? When you go deeply into it, through first because you have yourself somehow touched the fringe at least of transcendence and its activity, and then because of study, you will understand and interpret what the ancient scriptures have taught less inaccurately than if you merely study because you've got a brilliant brain. Right. So perhaps we can begin to understand the meaning of utter purity. That creative activity has no impurity whatsoever in it. If it has impurity, then the phenomenon which brings about creation will be one which will also bring about pain, sorrow, anxiety, sickness, decay, and death. Because the impurity means that one is in the state of sin. And the wages of sin is death. Death the destroyer. Death the punisher, the pain bringer. There is another aspect of death. The Lord of Death is the immortal twin of the Lord of Life. Life means growth, means development, evolution, call it what you like. But how can there be growth excepting through continuous change? The very meaning of activity is continuous change. There is that supremely transcendent state of total inaction, as we would call it, which is the original meaning of the Greek chaos, where this primordial energy is just like that, vibrating. Here now, no space, no time, no producing shapes, no differentiation, completely undifferentiated. But when karma, eros, acts, the differentiation starts and a mighty universal process comes into being. But it comes into being in terms of purity, absolute purity. If we can understand this, if we can even begin to understand this, we see the true meaning and the right place of celibacy. We will see that any enforced celibacy with the desire to gain spiritual benefit only brings you to your death in course of time, which will inevitably come anyway, brings you to your death, suffering a great deal quite unnecessarily. The true celibate is one who naturally becomes celibate. He just grows naturally, spontaneously into the condition of celibacy because he has grown pure in his mind and heart, and he has understood the nature of the creative process. And when he has understood that, the creative energies in us which act biologically so powerfully, sex is the most powerful factor in living creatures, in order to perpetuate the species. That energy, instead of functioning biologically, will naturally now function in terms of the capacity to live in the profoundest state of awareness of the totality, in which this timeless, creative, conjugative activity goes on transcendentally. Therefore, it has no more further need of biological expression. And it just naturally ends. When that happens, you realize complete peace within yourself. We all know, we have all been young, we have all had this urge which expresses through sex in us. We've all had it, we've all suffered through it, and so forth. But then at last, when it has come to its fulfillment, then the urge has no further need for biological expression. It becomes a transcendental creative energy. And it enables you, whenever you pay attention and direct your mind to things transcendental, you really just are at home with them. It is important to realize this. Now, when therefore one's mind has become one with the universal mind, the psyche, utterly purified, becomes one with the universal mind. And the universal mind functions directly through the senses and the body and the brain, God comes home to reside in your living body. When that happens, then you are permanently in tune with the reality of divine love. Those of you who are interested in the Upanishads, you will find that marvelous discourse in the greatest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, that marvelous discourse which the teacher Yajnavalkya gives to his wife Maitreyi. The name Maitreyi means the beloved. Maitri is friendship, love, pure and simple friendship, love. Maitreyi is her name. And the discourse he gives is a discourse on love which scholars have found difficult to understand. And they have given all kinds of petty little explanations. One can smile at those explanations after one has seen for oneself. What Yajnavalkya says is, not for the sake of the husband is the husband dear. I would prefer to use the word love in this context. Not for the love of the husband is the husband dear, but for the love of the Atma, the supreme ultimate reality, is the husband dear. Not for the love of the wife is the wife dear, but for the love of the Atma, the ultimate reality, which is in this timeless creative conjugative activity, is the wife dear. And so he goes on mentioning sons, friends, and all the rest of it, things, cattle, everything he mentions. And then he says something of supreme importance. He says, if the love of the Atma is not there, then all these things, wife, husband, child, property, everything disappears. You see? Now, if there is this love of the Atma, this awareness of the transcendent meaning of love, then one sees quite clearly that love, life, death, immortality, all go together. They are all one. They are one and the same reality. I have already said life and death are immortal twins. When we look at it, when we understand it, when we somehow or other in the slightest measure experience it within ourselves, life and death are immortal twins, everlastingly together. You see, supposing you look at a vibration, it's that and that, then that and that. What we call life, what we call death. What we call life, what we call death. But the reality, the ultimate reality, is immortal. There is no death which is destruction in it. That is why I have called death the other life. But it is not the other life of me as a separate entity, because any particular separate entity necessarily comes into being, is born, That is why we say, oh, that's another person, or that's another thing. The moment there is an otherness present, then there is birth. And whatsoever is born will change and die. So death really means other life, not in the sense of the continuity of me as a separate creature. Do realize that. If you can begin to see that, you will also touch the deepest depth of the meaning of love. Because it is only if I can let that which I call me and which I think of as I myself, when I can let that completely go, then what happens? This has become absolutely has come into the state of complete harmony, of complete communion with the one transcendent reality, in which there is no birth, no death. This is the meaning of immortality. There is no other immortality. When you really see this and you let go of this clinging to life, you have freed yourself from the noose of death. And the Lord of death will not strangle you when your time comes. Because that strangling by the Lord of death is the punishment of sin, the state of separateness, I. And I want to continue in this total creative process as a separate I. Therefore, I'm interfering with the total creative process. And that is sin. Is it not? So you see, love, life, death, the other life. And this death, the other life, is that aspect of this creative energy which brings everything to perfection, to fruition. Look, here and now, everywhere around us, you see it happening. Look at the leaves on the trees. Some of them have become autumn leaves, and they are ready to fall. But they do not fall out of their time, out of order. When the right forces are at play, there is a wind blowing or something happening, and then the leaf falls down by itself. And the leaf doesn't know it, doesn't want to know it, has no concern about it. There is no pain, there is no sorrow. And if there is a little wind blowing, which is only another part of the creative energy in action, if there is a wind blowing, you will see one of the most beautiful and wonderful sights. There are the branches shaking, and this leaf separates itself, becomes separate, and it comes absolutely like that, quivering, dancing with ecstasy as it meets the ground. And when it meets Mother Earth, there it is, peaceful, silent, unobtrusive, not hating, not resenting, not desiring. Isn't that perfection? Isn't that love in its supreme form? This free and easy movement from what we sometimes call, what we ordinarily call life, into what we ordinarily call death. Where then is the fear of death? Where then is the mistaken pursuit of an immortality which is merely a foolish mind-projected image? The reality is so marvelous, so beautiful. And this is the meaning, the origin, the source, the procedure of what we call
divine love.